Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, I'm Suzanne Constantine and this is my wardrobe malfunction, where we talk about clothes, life and anything else we fancy. This is our 15th episode, recorded over Zoom during lockdown in July 2020. You can also find it as a video version on our website at mywardmal.com. Here, you can also join our pyjama party and email your own clothing stories to help at mywardmal.com. And if you like what you hear, go on, give us a 5-star review and rating and follow us on the usual socials at mywardmal. Right, today's guest is the first political figure to step into my wardrobe. I hoped I was going to love her, and you know what? I absolutely bloody adored her. So much so that I'm taking her shopping the next time I'm in her neck of the woods. Who is it? It's member of the Scottish Parliament, author, columnist, radio host, and self-confessed crisp fetishist. Try saying that after a few more whiskies. Ruth Davidson! So, let's grab the handles, open my wardrobe doors, and find out what's inside. Wardrobe malfunction. We've had Nile Rodgers, Kristen Scott Thomas, Elizabeth Hurley, but I can genuinely say that I am more excited about our next guest than I have been about all of those put together, because today I'm speaking to Ruth Davidson. Ruth, you're here. I can't believe it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I mean, I have to say, you're reading out that list of people who are regularly in glossy magazines and everyone remembers the Liz Hurley dress and the kind of the English Patient wardrobe from that period that Kristen Scott Thomas had. And I'm just going, what on earth am I doing talking to you about clothes? Because I know nothing about clothes.
But that's the beauty of it. That is the beauty of you. And I just think that because of the success that you've had, the arena you're in, your personal life, someone like you is so much, you're bigger than the sum of what you wear. So for me, and it's kind of like, I'm going to be so interested to find out whether you actually give a shit about clothes or whether it's, you know, you dress, because I've noticed that you always dress in block colours, don't you?
Yeah. I do.
I've never seen you in a print.
No, I have prints, but for work, I tend to wear a dark suit and like quite colourful. As you can see, I do like colour. Quite a colourful kind of cami top or vest top or something like that. So yeah. I think I'm so unsure about clothing, and I do like clothes and I like shopping and all the rest of it. But I'm so unsure that I like safe space.
Yeah.
And I've always liked uniforms, not in a fetish or a you can't go through my personal history kind of a way. But, you know, at school, I never minded wearing a school uniform. And I was in the Territorial Army for quite a while. So, I'm good at ironing creases into trousers. And I like when I'm sure of what I'm doing. So in a work setting, I can wear a trouser suit and that's fine. And I'm never going to be caught out. I quite like black tie functions. I know what a long dress is. I quite like frocking up, you know, very happy with that. Where I struggle is the in-betweens. So smart casual sends me into paroxysms of I don't know what that means. And when I first got elected, I was once invited down to one of these horrible things you have to do to help raise money for political parties, a party fundraiser in London, and it was cocktail dress. And it turns out that what my idea of a cocktail dress is and what people in a very fashionable, very rich, smart set of London's idea of what a cocktail dress is completely different. And I felt like somebody's country cousin. All I was missing was the stalk of corn coming out of my mouth. And I just felt horrendous.
What were you wearing?
I was wearing like just a little black dress, sort of to knee length and stuff, which I thought was what a cocktail dress. I don't go to many cocktail parties, I have to say. It wasn't really part of my like my life before this. But, you know, there was an awful lot of people that were wearing very, very stylish things and not something that was bought from the high street for 50 quid, you know. Yeah. And maybe I didn't accessorise enough. Maybe that's what I should have done.
No, because a little look at someone like Audrey Hepburn, you know, she lived and died in a little black dress and she was considered the most stylish person in the world.
Yeah, I'm not Audrey Hepburn.
Fair enough, Ruth.
I think you've got to have an insouciance to wear things like Audrey Hepburn, and yeah. I maybe don't have that.
Yeah. But it's I mean, I so hear you when you say you've kind of you've created this uniform for yourself, and I, you know, having looked at photographs and read articles about you, it's so clear that you have that uniform, and it's like I said, it's block colours, it's navy, black, sometimes grey and red, and
red, orange and pinks. So I usually wear red, orange, pinks or a light blue underneath a navy suit. Yeah. But yeah, and it's just because I don't know any better. I'm not confident. And
it's not some kind of protection. You don't wear that as some kind of protection. Or is it just because...
Well, I think... Well, partly the navy and black. I mean, actually, if you go kind of further back to older pictures of me, I would wear skirt suits with boots in the winter, and I would wear other coloured suits. When I got pregnant and then when I had my child and couldn't shift the baby weight, I only had two suits that fitted me. They were a navy suit and a black suit. So there is like basically a year and a half's period where I was refusing to throw out any suits that I couldn't fit anymore or buy any more in the next size up. So I literally just did wear the only ones that were roomy enough for me. Yes. And it was because I didn't want to be looked at because I was heavy and all that sort of stuff, which I think a lot of people.
Yeah, we all identify. All women identify with that.
When you're in the really fat end of your wardrobe, like that's a difficulty, and you don't want looked at. So
do you divide your wardrobe up like that? So you have it in kind of sizes. Are you that organised? I don't believe you are.
No, I'm not. But I know exactly which suits are at the tighter end of the size that they are and which ones are at the wider end. So I kind of, I've got, weirdly, it's in my spare room, I've got a kind of clothing reel. My partner's brother used to have sports shops over in Ireland. And when we moved into this house, which we haven't done anything with and we need to, there wasn't enough hanging space in it. So instead of like getting fitted wardrobes and paying for all of that, we paid for IVF instead. So I've got like just a blank clothing reel in my spare room, which has sort of shirts, dresses, skirts, and then just suits.
Yeah.
And then everything else is just in drawers. But
you've always paid attention to your makeup. You always wear great lipstick. Oh, and you do your eyes really well, and you pluck your eyebrows. You've got good shaped eyebrows.
I do pluck my eyebrows because I'm so dark that if I don't, you know, I can become the third Gallagher pretty quickly if I don't. So I have to do that. But also, again, with makeup, I wear the same makeup. So it's always a kind of brown shimmery eyeshadow.
Yeah.
Black mascara. Sort of, I wear a kind of a cream foundation, and then I put powder on top just to make it matte. Because we have so many kind of cameras, both sort of film cameras and snapper cameras, you can't be sweaty. You just, and particularly politicians, like you look as if you really are lying if you're sweaty. Which is why I would always say to men, you know, don't be proud about this. Wear makeup on camera, define your eyes. Because I used to work in TV as well before.
Yeah.
So not really. I was mostly in radio, but I did a little bit of television. And one of the cameramen there was the one that got me started on block colours. He was like, you know, it will pop. So it used to be scarves. I used to have a really bright scarf with, you know, a nice coat. I kind of like winter better than summer because it's easier to dress. And, you know, I've tried to get some of my male colleagues to not be quite so West of Scotland male about it. Like, nobody's going to worry about, you know, your predilections if you put a little bit of mascara or eyeliner on, just so you're on the telly, you just don't look like a blank page. But I still have some way to go in that.
But that must be very difficult in the political arena, because I suppose it's a bit like a woman working in the city, where it certainly was sort of in the 80s,
about, because women in the 80s, they'd go to the city and they'd go to their banks or whatever, and they'd dress in pinstripe suits, literally, to fit in. And I mean, I think that in politics, they're still a way behind. I mean, do you find that you have to dress in quite a sensible, masculine, not masculine, but...
Oh, I mean, I think... Way? Honestly, I mean, I think if I wasn't in the public eye, I think there would be more times that I would wear things that perhaps were a bit more masculine, because I like men's clothes. And
yeah,
I think I don't know where I would really fall. You know, being a gay woman, I don't know where I would really fall. I'm clearly not a high femme, but I don't think I'm really down the kind of the other end of very, very butch lesbian either. But I like, you know, so this is what I would wear for fun, is I'm in a pair of black jeans, a nice set of brogue boots and a shirt. She's probably a bit more masculine, I think. And certainly when I was first elected, I was the first openly gay leader of a major political party anywhere in the UK. I wore a lot more skirts and dresses with a jacket on top, because I thought I had to and not scare the horses a little bit. And I would wear, I was a bit lost actually, I wore kind of chunkier necklaces and stuff like that. That's just not me. I just, you know, I like a bit of bling when I go to like a black tie event or something
you
like
went
that.
Went down the Theresa May route with her big necklaces.
Not that big.
Okay.
It's all relative. But like I had like a bit of paste and stuff around the neck and had some pearls and stuff. But to be honest, it's just, I think people just prefer you if you're just yourself. People know if you're trying too hard. So just
totally
yourself. But I mean, I think I leave in March, so I've not got long left. And I think that I probably will on occasion go to a black tie event in a women's tux. Other than a dress as well. You know, I think I would mix it up more that way and be a bit braver. And also, like, I've turned 40 now, I care less. Like, the cartoonists have made every single fat joke they can about me, so I kind of don't care anymore. I want to enjoy, like, I'm also happier with myself and in myself than I've ever been. And I think that's one thing that makes older women so attractive, just generally.
Yeah, confidence.
Is that confidence and that sense of self and growing into yourself and just owning yourself. And I think I own myself so much better than I ever used to. And I'm not lost and in my 20s anymore. I know exactly who and what I am and what matters to me.
So did that change, do you think, when you gave birth to Finn?
I think that's part of it, but I think I was already quite a long way on that road.
Okay, yeah.
I think, you know, my 30s were the biggest kind of growth decade for me, completely. I mean, I think in my 20s, I was still running around pretending I was in my teens for a lot of it. Yeah. But cling on with their fingernails.
So when did you first realise that, or have you always known you were gay? And did that have like
No.
So that must have been, you didn't, but did you subconsciously know, do you think?
I think plenty of people around me probably subconsciously knew, but I might have been the last to know. So I didn't come out until my mid-20s.
Late. But had you girlfriends or anything before that? Were you too
scared
to?
No, I was, no, my first female partner was when I was in my mid-20s. So I was quite late to it. And I'd had boyfriends all through school and university and things like that. So, and I was one of those people that sort of edged out in that, you know, I fell for someone and did the whole, well, I've fallen for the person, not the gender thing. And then, you know, been on a road and then realised that actually, who am I kidding? Women are brilliant. I love them.
Yeah. So do I. I'm just women, strong women. All my best friends are strong, powerful women and gay men.
We've got to have a couple of them around.
Essentially. Do you think your Presbyterian background had, I mean, I don't know much about that at all, but did that, I mean, how do they look at being gay and homosexuality? Are they kind of open-minded about it, or did that have an impact on you coming out when you were in your 20s?
Yeah, I mean, I think my faith and the church that I'm in was part of the reason that I fought it for as long as I did.
Okay.
And, you know, my father's not religious, my mum is pretty religious, and I had was brought up in the Church of Scotland, and which itself has come on a huge journey, and is, you know, is so much better than it used to be on issues like this. I still can't marry my wife or my fiancé in my own church, but we'll get there someday.
Really? I didn't realize that.
So Church of Scotland, she's Irish, so she's Roman Catholic, so neither of us can get married in our own church.
Yeah.
Although when we got, it was really sweet actually, when we got engaged and it was in the paper, the Scottish Episcopal Church, which does carry out same-sex ceremonies, were within the week, were emailing, bidding for the wedding. But we kind of thought, given that we're already a mixed marriage, we probably don't want to introduce a third sort of location in there. So that was quite funny. But, I think, you know, you read kind of what's there and Paul's letters to as many churches and all the rest of it. And when you're classified alongside idolaters and adulterers and all the rest of it, I mean, you do kind of take that on board. But I think as well, the problem that we had particularly, I mean, I came out sort of 15 years more than that now, so things have changed a lot. But even then, there was this sense that the Venn diagram, like, Christians were on one side and gay people on the other, and there was no crossover in the middle, and that's just not true. And it's as hard to come out as a Christian in certain gay groups as it is to come out as being gay in some churches. But we have come, like, I mean, I cannot tell you how far we've come in the 15, 16 years since I came out.
And have you had, I mean, were you quite active in that, in kind of getting the message out and trying to make it more acceptable within the church and within politics?
Yeah, I mean, I think in both. I mean, I was very active in my church. Like I say, I grew up in it. I'm a former Sunday school teacher, although why anyone would let me be in charge of the spiritual guidance of 8-year-olds, I don't know. And in terms of being open about sexuality, I mean, for me, just the way it was, it wasn't one of those ones where you kind of, you only come out to your friends but not your family or anything like that. So once I was out I was all the way out, and then I started running for elections and things like that, so it was the adjective that was always put in front of my name, so there was never kind of anything about it. But even in my job, one of the very early jobs I had at the BBC when I first started there, when I was like 21 or 22, was kind of booking guests for programs, and it was always right, okay, there's some furore about a gay issue, let's phone the Catholic Church and get them on the other side, and would often kind of intervene with the producer or the editor to say, well look, this, you know, let's think a bit smarter here. It doesn't always have to be an antagonistic relationship. I didn't always win, but you know, it was always worth trying, because I just think it's not true.
Yeah. So when you were in your before you came, were you at university before you came out?
Yeah, so I went to uni at 17.
Oh, that's young.
System, and I'm the sort of younger half of my year in the Scottish system.
Okay.
For who hires and not A-levels and six-year studies. So I went off at 17 thinking that I knew everything about the world. Had a very rude awakening. I went to Edinburgh Uni, which had a lot of people that had done A-levels, then got off and done a gap year or two.
Yeah, a lot of posh class, yeah.
Well, I would never call them that, but there was there was a lot of tasselly loafers, a lot of gilets, a lot of people that had built orphanages in Tanzania. And, you know, and they just had this super sheen of confidence that I couldn't match. And they were loud. And I guess the brashness of it was really difficult for a wee lassie from a wee village in Fife, you know.
Did you retreat, or did you then want to kind of fight against that? Did you want to kind of almost take it on, because there's that awful thing with you know, and I have quite a posh background, and it's that those questions, like the two questions which I hate more than fucking anything are, where did you go to school and what does your father do?
Do you know, like, I'd never ever had those questions until Freshers Week at university, and people were like, which school do you go to? I'm like, well, I don't think you'll ever have heard of it, Buckhaven High School, you know. And I remember this one kind of thing that they do at Edinburgh where you, like, at the end of Freshers Week, you climb this big mountain called Arthur's Seat in the middle of the city and watch the sunrise and all this sort of thing. And I was up there doing that with hundreds of other freshers, and there was some chap with, you know, tasselly loafers and a signet ring on his pinky, you know, the type, and the pink shirt. I don't even know if this is true, but I just have this distinct memory of him going, yeah, well, my father was captain of the ship that sunk the Belgrano. And I'm going, yeah, I wouldn't really boast about that, mate. Do you know what I mean? or he might not have been the captain, but he was like the executive officer or something like that. And I was just quite like,
what a fucking stupid thing.
I'm like, really? We're doing this at 5 a.m. pissed on a mountaintop, are we? Oh, all right then, mate. So yeah, I didn't bring him into my friends group, I think it's fair to say.
Oh my God, that is just hilarious. Oh, Ruth. But so then, I mean, you at that point, well, you'd suffered from depression. Let's bring it right down again. You suffered from depression before that. Was that when a friend of yours committed suicide, was it, in your village? Or
yeah, so when I was at university, so at the tail end of my first year, I think that was the trigger. I've never really unpacked all of it, but I was run over when I was 5. I really, really badly injured. Broke my leg, fractured my pelvis, severed the main artery in my leg. Had that all crushed, severed the nerve down the front of my leg, and I was in hospital for weeks and weeks and weeks. And they had to save me first, and then they had to save the leg. So that's one of the reasons I kind of walk a bit funny is because I was a bit mangled because I was hit by a truck. So I had a really, really long kind of road to rehab. And it so happens that a boy that was a bit older than me that lived across the road from me was run over on the same stretch of road a few years after I was. He wasn't as badly injured as me. And I was having quite a torrid time at university anyway. And then I don't know whether his suicide was the trigger or whether it just happened to be an unfortunate confluence of events. But I really, really struggled with the idea that I had lived and he hadn't. And there was a real kind of weird survivor's guilt about it. And the thing that's really odd is that Martin and I, we weren't that close. You know, we weren't best mates. We didn't go out to the pub together. Like, it was a small village, so everybody knew each other. His dad had been my clarinet teacher at primary school, you know what I mean? Like, and I'd washed pots in the golf club that he'd been a member of and things like that. But some of my friends were much closer friends to him and weren't affected in the same way. But for whatever reason, I really struggled. And at that time, like I say, this is a long time ago, this would be sort of 17, 18 years ago.
Yeah.
Maybe long, oh goodness, this might be, oh no, 21 years ago. No. Oh dear, I'm so older than I thought. let me work this out. This was in 1997, at the start of 97. This is 23 years ago. So yeah, okay, 23, goodness, how old am I? Anyway, so 23 years ago, the way in which university health centres at that time dealt with it was they just threw some pills at you, basically.
Yeah.
And I had a really bad reaction to the pills, but I didn't know that that's what it was. So I kept going back going, you know, things are worse, not better. So they just kept going, right, well, we'll just double your dose until I got onto the maximum you could be on. And I have to be really careful about how I say this because the company that makes the particular brand that I was on is quite litigious. But there has been a number of class actions around the world regarding side effects for this particular brand of antidepressant, which particularly in adolescents and young adults, one of its side effects is increased suicidal thoughts and tendencies, which I would suggest is not brilliant for an antidepressant. So I had sort of 2 or 3 years that were pretty dark and pretty bad. And then sort of graduated and started putting myself back together again.
And so do you think you've chucked away the pills, I assume, and have you ever kind of, because I've been down that road too, and my mum was severely bipolar, manic depressive, and trying to commit suicide every 5 minutes. So I'm kind of very aware of that and very conscious of it, and I'm always looking out for it in my kids because apparently it can skip a generation.
Hmm.
But have you, and then I was fine for a long time. I had it a lot when I was a child, and I thought it was homesickness because I was sent away to boarding school and I was miserable. So I didn't really an anxiety and fear, but it was depression. And since then, and then I was fine. But then when I had my first my first child, I got postnatal depression, which I didn't know what it was. And I had it for 8 years, all through all pregnancy, just thinking, okay, well, this is how people feel. You know, this is how what I'm feeling is normal. And so have you managed to put it behind you, or do you think you have a propensity?
Well, I'm one of the people that's of the view that it's not something that you have and then don't have. It's not something that you can fix. Always it's something there. That you manage. Yeah. It's something that's kind of always there, and that you manage it. And you have to kind of be aware of when things could be difficult and put in places your own coping mechanisms for it. So something like the start of lockdown, the idea of not having necessarily a routine, not having the freedom to exercise. If you're not getting up for work at the same time every day, you could do that thing that I certainly used to do when I was a student, which was become nocturnal, like your sleeping habits change, that sort of thing. So I was really super on it and cut down on my drinking. God, that makes me sound like a drinker. I don't, but I mean, I almost cut alcohol completely out of what I was doing. I made sure I went to bed at the same time every night. It turns out that all the hundreds of pounds I've been spending every year on gym fees and personal trainers, I didn't need to. All I needed was the government to tell me you're not allowed to exercise more than once a day. And I was mad for the exercise, couldn't get me out of my trainers. So I was really on that, made sure I did loads of that, started doing other kind of control measures as well, and just made sure that I managed this period, just because I'm so scared of ever going back to where I was when I was sort of 18, 19, 20, because it was such a dark time. That is my biggest fear, is that I ever go back there. Yeah. And so there have been times where, I've been at risk, where I've had to work really hard to keep my head above water.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When I was 25, I broke my back in quite a bad injury when I was in the... I jumped head first through a window frame on command and landed badly. I have a really cavalier attitude to personal safety. So
I'm a bit the same, yes.
So that was a period where I knew I could be in a bit of trouble. Once I got out of hospital and they'd given me this kind of back brace and stuff, I'd been signed off my work for 3 months. And I begged my GP to write me a letter to say that I could go in. And then I went into my work and I badgered. I just kept going up the line to boss, to boss, to boss, saying, no, you don't understand. I have to come into work. I have to work. I cannot sit at home watching Homes Under the Hammer for three months, because it will rot my brain quicker than heroin. And I was more frightened of going into a bad place that I never want to return to than I was of perhaps not fully healing my back or having future back pain. Because in terms of the payoff, one was of a magnitude of difference to the other. To me.
Yeah. But do you think we're not really talking about clothes much, are we? We'll get back there. But
I've got something here to show you, which is my biggest fail.
It's like that thing. So I really identify, I empathize and identify, and it's kind of like, by doing that and keeping busy, and yes, it's one of our coping mechanisms. So I'm saying I find exercise, and if I feel, I get that kind of cloud descending, I'll keep busy, I'll go for a run, I'll do da da da. But sometimes I wonder that, should I just sit down with it? Am I running? Is it running away from it? Is it, should one just sit down and absorb it and try and analyze it sometimes making peace? But I guess it's it can be it's a chemical imbalance very often, isn't it?
I think I would never suggest that the way I sort of fought myself out of this way back 20 some years ago, as I discovered, is the way that is right for everybody. It's just the way that was right for me.
Yeah.
And I think that there are people for whom it is better for them to take the time to breathe, to slow down, to absorb it, and then to work their way through it. Now, the problem that I have is I find that I fall further, or at least I'm scared that I would fall further, and it would be harder to fight my way back out. Yeah. So I would rather try and outrun it than to sit still and let it consume me, and all of the other things that go along with that, and the way in which other people are affected in your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there's, you know, I'm not single anymore. I have family responsibilities.
It's a responsibility. Your mental health, exactly, is a responsibility, not just for yourself, but for
I feel that it's a responsibility for the people around me. You know, I'm the main breadwinner for my family. I've got to, you know, there's things that I've got to do, the responsibilities that I have that I can't step out of, nor would I ever want to, because that in itself would I think be damaging for me and the way in which I kind of work through things. So for me, and I'm really clear that people deal with this better differently and in their own situation, but for me and for my situation, I believe it is better when I have it. And to be fair, you know, I've done really well in the last few years in quite a high stress job, and I was worried when I took the job that, you know, that could be an issue, but I've done all right, I think. For me, it is better to stave it off than to sit, absorb, and then come out the other side.
Is that why you didn't, because we were all screaming for you to stand for Prime Minister? Come on, Ruth. Is that why you chose not to do that? Because
that's a very easy question, on the grounds that I couldn't, because I'm not an MP. In the rural state, you have to be. So, you know, I was sitting in a whole... So even if I had wanted to, and I've been very clear, you know, I have seen the job from the other side of the door at number 10. I've been very privileged to be and watch prime ministers at work. And it is possibly the loneliest job in the world. And it's not just about valuing my own mental health, which I do, and I put a value on it, but it's also about valuing the family that I've built here. I mean, I the intolerable pressure that, you know, living in a gilded cage is still a cage. And it might be a cage that you choose, but it's not a cage that your family chooses. So I think that, you know, even in the very small sort of corner of the sphere of politics and scrutiny and kind of the Scottish press at you that I've been in, you know, the sacrifices that people in my life have had to make when it wasn't the job they chose, you know, I do have a responsibility to look after them too.
Yeah, I hear you totally. But yeah, it's a shame for all of us. But Ruth, what's your greatest insecurity? What's your biggest kind of like physical insecurity?
I don't like being frightened of things. Okay. I really hate that.
Yeah.
So I sometimes force myself to do things that I know I shouldn't in order to not be scared of them.
Like what?
Oh, that's a really good question. Like running to be the leader of a political party when you've been in the job 3 minutes. Like that's quite a big thing.
that's also true. It's kind of, again, I'm totally, I'm the same.
Also, like failing in public. I mean, you know, in a different eye, we're in the public eye in a different way. But,
like fools.
You know, you kind of want to be private when you mess up. You don't want it to be across all the newspapers. You don't want people to be laughing at you or shouting at you. And politics, because it's so adversarial, you've got, you know, your own little team that sit in a parliament beside you, some of whom are, you know, desperate for your job and would quite happily see you fail and work towards that, but mostly are on your side. And then you've got everybody else in the parliament whose job it is to make you fail.
Yeah.
Like, because they only get more votes if you get less votes. So I guess doing something like becoming leader within 6 months of becoming a professional politician means that you fail in public a lot because you've got to learn. And I don't like being bad at things, and I don't like letting people down, and I've always found that not letting people down is a much stronger driver than, you know, trying to make people proud of you or trying to impress people or whatever. That doesn't actually interest me. But not letting people down, that's the most important thing.
Mm. And were you criticised a lot for your appearance? Were you? Did the media give you a hard time? Your appearance.
I mean, like I say, a lot of that is weight related rather than what I wear. And also, you know, I've got a really round face. I've got very narrow eyes. Like I'm quite easy to lampoon. So, yeah. So, which is fine. I mean, yeah, but, yeah. You know, to be fair, I kind of bring quite a bit of it on myself. I once accepted an award at a political award show, which are terrible. I don't know why they give politicians awards. It's awful. It's like just the most cringeworthy thing ever. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I once accepted an award saying that it was a brilliant day because not only was I winning this, but earlier that night, I'd also come second in a Kim Jong-un lookalike competition. So, you know, it's kind of my own fault.
Yeah, you just, you know what, it's kind of like, I think you just got to celebrate what people criticize you for at the end, and then you can get through anything.
Well, also, you know, I have a partner who loves me, I've got a fantastic little boy, I've got a close family.
Yeah.
What other people that don't know you say about you, it turns out it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter, yeah.
And you can have all the Twitter pitchforks and mobs, yeah. And you know, the ones that do cut through, the ones that do hurt are actually people that you have met or you've have come into your orbit at some point and you think, wait a minute, that's one, what you're saying is not fair, and two, you should know better than that. So they're the ones that get to you, and they're very occasional. But but just like the 55-year-old men that are still living in their mum's basements that are tweeting in their underpants, like water off a duck's back. Like you literally do not matter to what I'm trying to achieve for my family and me and my happiness and my work achievements. Like, if that is getting through any armor that I have, then that's my problem, not theirs.
Yeah, no, that's so true. And it's kind of like what other people, I always feel that what other people think of me is none of my business. I always say that to myself. It's just none of my business. I don't know them. It's not my business.
Also, the idea that somebody is spending time thinking about you is really sad.
Yeah, no.
I'm not spending time thinking about them. I'm trying to get stuff done.
Okay, so when you became leader, did you have people fussing around you to see, you know, make sure you were wearing the right thing, that your hair was perfect, your makeup was perfect? I can't kind of believe you did, but...
Yeah, no, not really. So, it's not like being the Prime Minister or something down here where you have like a driver and an entourage and all the rest of it. Being the leader of an opposition party in Scotland, you've got a nice young man, and it usually is a young man that helps carry your kit around with you. Mm-hmm. And that's about it. That's it, you know, did my own driving for, you know, throughout the whole thing, like all of that sort of stuff. So so you don't have an entourage for a start. But I did, because I wanted to not let people down and stuff. I did let myself get talked into having my colours done.
Okay.
So I have somewhere got like one of those little books with all your colours in it.
Were you a winter? Were you told you were a winter?
I think it was a bit weird. It was an ex-bank manager that did this on the side out of her house in Jordan Hill in Glasgow. Oh. And I'm not sure how professional a service it really was. She was a lovely woman, don't get me wrong. But I mean, it had things like yellow in there. And I don't think anyone suits yellow, really. Not when they're as pale as this. It had blues, browns, blacks, greys in terms of kind of base colours. And it also had every other colour, purples and reds and pinks, and but also like pale green, like the paint that all municipal buildings got painted in the 1890s. Like that was in there, a kind of pale minty green. And again, it just washes you out. It's awful. So
dual colours for you, which you wear, your jewel, like sapphire and ruby and...
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's that. Okay. You're winter.
Right, okay. Well, I will take that to the bank. Thank you.
Yeah.
But so if you want to come and actually show me how to dress...
I will.
I would love that. Come and do that.
Can I do
that? Yeah, of course. That'd be brilliant.
Should we shake?
Yeah, let's shake on it.
Okay, I'm coming up. I'm going to take you shopping.
If there's any shops left after coronavirus.
Oh, yeah, I know.
You know, I feel so sorry for retailers.
Let's not go there because it's just
I do. I feel for business owners generally and retailers in particular, because retail was having such a tough time
anyway.
And like I say, you know, part of Jen's family's all worked in retail and all the rest of it, and I know it's really, really tough. And some people have done very well, that have got good online offerings, but there is a point where you want to go into a shop, you want to see things, you want to see windows that are dressed, you want to try clothes on, you want to, you know, you want to, you don't just want a plastic bag to come through the letterbox and then send it back 3 days later because it doesn't fit. You know, you want the experience of retail as well.
And it's such a part of kind of communities as well. You know, people, it's a social thing, mothers and daughters and friends going out to shop, and it's devastating, and God knows what the answer is. But yeah, we'll find the last few shops, even if we have to breadth and length of the country, we'll do it. Do you have, I would imagine in politics, you've got to be strong all the time, you know, emotionally strong. You've got to have your armour and your protection. So do you have a comfort blanket of any kind? And it could be something that sort of either protects you or comforts you?
Like clothing wise, do you mean?
Clothing wise, yeah. Oh, it could be anything. Is there something that comes with you almost everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, I do love, like I say, I do love a kind of brightly coloured scarf. And in winter, and I actually don't care what kind of suit or boots or whatever I'm wearing, as long as I've got a nice kind of, usually 3/4 length or quite long kind of fitted coat, like nice black. Or navy coat with like a bright scarf, and I always feel like I look all right.
Yeah,
like that, and that covers a lot multitude of sins. And also in places where, you don't really know what the dress code's going to be or that sort of thing. I think, you know, as long as you look neat, you kind of get away with most things. So I like clean lines. I don't like fussy things. I don't like frills. I don't like, you know, kind of epaulettes and tassels and all that sort of thing. Yeah. I never really have done like a nice, something that's well cut. I mean, or that has a clean line.
Yeah.
I just personally quite like, I don't have lots of ornaments in my house. I'm quite an unfussy person. But I don't rings or anything.
You know? That's right for you. Cause you've got quite big boobs and those are I'm the same. And as soon as I put a frill on, I look like a barmaid. As soon as I wear a pattern, I look like a kind of sort of dowager matron. Sorry, that's my dog. Dowager matron. So it is, clean lines are great. And especially as we get older, I think that, you know, clean lines kill it every time. They're the best.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I've always had quite a big chest. And I think that, you know, I breastfed for 6 months as well. So it's not in the same place it used to be. So if we could do some underwear shopping as well when you come up,
for
that would
sure.
be brilliant.
Well, yeah, for sure. I'm literally now. Okay, look, hang on.
Oh, now, careful. Does this carry a health warning? Is this a 15?
It's just between you and me. Hang on. Here, I've got not one. So I've got two bras on. Can you see?
All right, okay.
Two bras on. So that's, I'm always trying to kind of
large
these. But anyway, but Ruth, have you ever, because I mean, you must have had so many opportunities to have a wardrobe malfunction.
Yes, I have. I want to show you that I think the funniest one that I've had, and it's not because it's in bad taste, although I'm pretty sure that there are people that think my taste is pretty questionable. I have a big sister and I've got a couple of older cousins who are also female. So I grew up in hand-me-downs my whole, you know, so I would have been vaguely fashionable 3 years after the fashion was the fashion.
Okay, you know? Classic.
Oh, yeah, that classic. But this is, I think, a not hideous, sort of bottle green, sort
beautiful
of
beautiful colour for you.
A cowl neck sheath dress. And this was a bridesmaid's dress. I was a bridesmaid for a very good friend of mine who lived in Adelaide in Australia. Because I was living in Scotland, she sent, and the other bridesmaids were all to the four winds, she sent a bolt of fabric over and said, just, we're going to have all the bridesmaids in this fabric, get a dress made that you want to wear, and it doesn't matter if they're all different, we will...
Never. Exactly.
So lovely. And because she'd been living in Scotland before she got engaged, And because there was lots of people flying over from Scotland and other countries to Australia, rather than have the turn up for the wedding, speak to the bride and groom for 5 minutes as they go round, and then they jump off on their honeymoon, and all these people have flown 3,500 miles, don't actually see them. What they chose to do, which was lovely, was they had us all over 3 weeks before the wedding. The wedding was all started. We all went on a road trip, all the Brits, with them for 3 weeks around the country. Lovely. We went to the Wine Valley. We went red snapper fishing in Coffin Bay. We had this lovely, lovely time of 3 weeks on holiday. And then we got to the morning of the wedding, and I put the dress on, except I couldn't. Didn't fit. I'd had 3 weeks on the lash.
You were too much
measured.
Stormies and
Foster. All of that sort of thing.
Completely
and like not wearable, like as in not even like sausage links.
Ruth.
What was fantastic? Oh yeah, because my weight is barometers up and down. It's really easy to put on weight and hard to take it off.
In three weeks, though.
Well, maybe a month.
What? Jesus Christ. Okay, yeah, go on.
Yeah, I mean, you can. It's not hard to put on half a stone in 3 weeks. And if it's a sheath dress, it's not going to be pretty. So the morning of my friend's wedding, and I still feel guilty about this, I'd also got a wrap, a kind of stole to wear over my arms.
Yeah.
We took a set of shears, and we went straight up the back of the dress, and the bride's mother and the bride's auntie sewed the stole in as a panel at the back. And you can actually see here. So they should have been looking forward to their daughter's wedding. They are sewing a panel into a dress for one of the Scottish bridesmaids that couldn't turn down a sausage sandwich. Isn't that the worst dress story you've ever heard?
But that is, you know what I love about that? It's not about getting, you know, being unfashionable or wearing the wrong type of thing. It's that dress let you down. But actually, you let the dress down. It's genius. Oh my God, yeah. That's the best story. But that, Ruth, is a fabulous colour. That's probably one of your best colours, and the orange.
I really like it. Actually, I really like dark greens. Mm. I don't wear them often. You're right, but I maybe when I'm free of politics, I'll wear more. I can blossom like a butterfly. I can exit my trouser suit chrysalis and blossom. Oh, like
you have, wait for me. I'm going to come and hold your hand. And my darling, so. What about your birthday suit? Is that a dress or a jacket or anything that is like your celebratory item of clothing?
Do you know, I've got some bling that I love to wear. It's not clothing. So I've got a kind of, I've got a double strand drop diamante. I mean,
nice.
But you know, set of earrings, and it's a chain that is, not a chain, it's like diamante there, and it's got a double strand drop as well, and they're asymmetric, which that's my kind of go-to dressing up. And I love a clutch bag as well, oddly. I don't know why. I don't like a handbag, but I love a clutch.
You love a clutch. Yeah, I'm always gonna leave it somewhere,
and I quite like a wrap. If I'm going to like an awards do or a posh do or a black tie or a dinner or something like that I've got to, I do quite like feeling like I'm playing the part.
Is that
Jean-Paul Sartre thing of he's not a waiter, he's playing the part of the waiter? I often feel like I don't fit in, so I often feel like I'm playing the part of it, but I feel like I'm playing the part properly. I've got a nice kind of, actually I think it comes from Marks and Spencer's of all places, but I've got a really nice kind of wrap thing that's kind of half wrap, half cape, but it's got a sparkle in it.
Nice.
And it's really nice weight to it.
Okay.
And the way it comes across is, I think it looks quite classy, and I don't often look classy, so that makes me walk half an inch taller.
Yeah, okay. And if
high heels that I can't walk in.
Oh no, but have you always had short hair too? Because you've got amazingly thick hair.
Yeah, and it's getting thicker. So I look like the fifth Beatle at the moment because my partner has been cutting it during lockdown.
She's
done all right, actually. Yeah. She's done okay, but I mean, it desperately needs...
Yeah.
We're in trouble in Scotland because we're not getting hairdressers open till the 15th. So we're going to be shaggy kind of Highland cattle, like looking out through the fringes for a bit longer. But I used to have a kind of bob down to about there.
How tall are you?
5'5".
Okay.
Just a smidge under 5'5".
Yeah.
So, but I go through phases where I grow it a bit and then realise that actually it just annoys me and I just want to cut it again.
You're so lucky that you suit short hair. I would love to have short hair, but my head then looks like a sort of pip growing out of a flower pot because I've got a really small head. I've got a little pip of a head. But I really envy people who can have short hair.
Yeah, I mean, I think, weirdly, it's quite hard to find a hairdresser that understands short hair.
Yeah, it's got to be cut really well. Sorry, Jen. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair to her, like, I think she did pretty well. I was quite nervous handing her the scissors. And then when she finished, I was like, oh, actually, that's all right. Do you want me to do you? And she was like, no, I'll do myself. Yeah. So she would have me nowhere near her doing hers. So. Yeah, but then I did clip the dog and it was awful. So she maybe has got a point.
Yeah, she had a point. All right, my darling. Well, listen, I'm going to let you go. But I really mean it. I will come up to Scotland. I come up to Scotland quite a lot. We go up to our family. We come up a lot. I love Scotland so much.
Where's your family based?
We go to near Blair Athol.
Oh, lovely, yeah.
And we go hiking in the Cairngorms there. And up a place called Glentilt. Oh, so stunning.
I love that road. So if you're driving up, say if you arrive at Edinburgh Airport or whatever, you're driving up and you've got these nice kind of, you've got the flatness of Fife and then you get to the kind of rolling hills and then, excuse me.
What is it, the A9?
You get to Perth and you've got that lovely kind of forest mixed deciduous that was planted to look like the Greenland. So you've got all these colours in it. And then suddenly you hit the Highland Line and you get the grandeur of the peaks. Because people think Scotland all looks the same and it doesn't. There's there's different elements of Scotland and that road takes you through a lot of them. And and then you get to where the Cairngorms, you get to the Scree and the kind of bracken.
Walking across Scree, nightmare.
Yes, it is.
Oh, I love it so much. It's where I feel... it's where I'm happiest. Glentilt is where I'm happiest.
Well, come on up. We'll stop off at George Street on the way.
I'm going to. Well, listen, I'm going to see you soon, honey. And Ruth, I'm so excited to have met you, and it's a real honour, and you're fucking great.
Oh, bless you.
What are you going to do after politics, by the way? Because you said you're stopping in March, is that right? Next year?
Yes. So the Parliament stops in March and then the elections in May. So you always have that break of kind of 6 weeks while those that are trying to get re-elected get elected. So I made some promises when I stood down, which was that I would be a bit more present. So I'm still got a few things that I'm looking at, but it's not going to be going from one big job to another big job. So I think I'm going to do little projects. So I've got more time in the house to spend with Finn and, you know, at some point, hopefully, maybe a little brother or sister for Finn. So.
Okay, fantastic. What a great future. Your imminent future is sorted and it sounds wonderful. It sounds blissful.
The next 3 or 4 years and then I'll get bored and then I'll have to do another big job again because as you've seen, I'm hyperactive. So I hate not doing things. So
the Duracell bunny. Well, listen, you are amazing. And thank you so much, Ruth. I love talking to you. I mean, I can't believe we've spoken for nearly an hour. It's just gone.
Oh, well, there you go.
Well, I'll see you soon.
Yeah, I'll see you soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.